Hi everyone, Anthony here. Just a quick message to say that if you're a fan of Unjustly Maligned, which I assume you are if you're listening to this, and you're also a signed up member of the Incomparable Network, then please go and check out the members only podcast feed for news of something a bit special that I want to do with this show for members later this year. If you're not yet a member of the Incomparable, what are you waiting for? Go to theincomparable.com/members. and join up today. Oh, and don't forget to tick the box for Unjustly Maligned when they ask you which shows you want to support. Thank you very much. All right, on with the show. Hello, and welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate the overlooked, ignored, derided, or the just plain hated. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, or even just doesn't know it exists, we'll find someone who loves it, and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is the journalist and podcaster, Warren Frey. Warren, welcome to the show.
Hello, everybody.
So, please tell us what you've come the show to talk about and give us some context around its production, its release, its reception, why it is maligned, and why you believe that that is wrong.
Okay, well, and I'm more or less going from a personal level here. I don't know how maligned it is because it got some fairly good reviews, but I'm defending Babe: Pig in the City, the sequel to the big hit Babe, mostly because I remember seeing it in the theater when it came out in 1998, I think. And just not expecting much because, you know, Babe's a nice, fun kids movie that's well made. Then I walk in and I see this movie and it's nothing. I mean, it is like the original movie, but it's also completely beyond the original movie and its ambition and scope and scale and mania. And I would tell people this and they just would not believe me. Like I would take nothing but flack. I used to work at a TV station as a master control operator. So we'd show this stuff and nobody would watch it. And I'd be like, why aren't you watching this amazing movie? And they just look at me like, it's about a talking pig. Yes, it's about a talking pig and his talking animal buddies, but there's so much more to it that you're missing if you don't watch. And I've actually had people like real blue collar, you know, tool push dudes going, yeah, that was actually pretty good after I forced them to watch it. But so that's why I to this day, I try to convince people and they always look at me like I'm crazy. And I'm like, just watch this movie and you will see what I'm saying. This movie has got so much going for it beyond a bunch of cute animals are talking to each other.
Wow. Well, I mean, you say that it's, you know, it was fairly well received when it came out and it wasn't panned certainly, but it also lost money. You know, it wasn't a sure thing as a sequel at all. It didn't make its budget back. It certainly, you know, didn't win any awards or nobody was giving it 5 stars or 2 thumbs up. So it is, you know, kind of overlooked. And being a sequel to, yes, a kids movie about a talking pig, that's not the sort of thing that's going to get you much credibility, you know?
No, it isn't, and that's why I fight this fight, damn it.
So, I mean, you mentioned that it's a departure from the original. Give us a bit of background then. Tell us about the original and why this one is so, as you say, sort of goes beyond it.
Well, the original, which I haven't seen since it came out, because I like this one so much better, is really a simple kid's story about a pig who learns how to herd sheep on a farm, and it's very charming, and everybody loved it, and became a big hit, and it's cute, and it's smartly written. And this one, Babe: Pig in the City, and I remember it came out about the same time as a bunch of other animal movies, presumably because Babe was so popular to begin with, all of which were obvious cash-ins, and this wasn't. The reason this is more complicated is because they immediately send the pig and the farmer's wife to the city, and then they just let their imaginations go wild. Like, it's done by George Miller, the guy who's made the Mad Max films and Happy Feet, which I haven't seen, and Lorenzo's Oil, I think, and The Witches of Eastwick. And this is going to sound weird, but if I had to draw a parallel, it would be with The Witches of Eastwick, because both movies have this weird equal mixture of dark and whimsy that somehow works. They're two very different movies. Witches of Eastwick is obviously a much more adult film, but they both have that sort of weird dark tone that's also a kind of whimsical tone at the same time. And that is not easy to pull off. Tim Burton tries and earlier on succeeded, and I think later on just kind of cashed in and gave up. But this movie succeeds effortlessly at that, and there's just so much imagination packed into it. I'm going to grab another movie that isn't really related, but in another way is. Like, Children of Men is a real downer of a movie, but if you look at it, it's so densely packed with imaginative stuff that builds up the world behind every shot, and that's what this has. This has got tons and tons of stuff that really builds up this weird fantasy scape that they end up in the city. which makes it feel like it's a picture book. Or another way I explained it, because I watched it a couple days ago with a friend of mine, because she'd never seen it. I said, it's like a New Yorker cartoon on mescaline, basically. Because it feels like a New Yorker cartoon with all the characters in it. There's a great line where this the whole plot behind it is there's this one house in the middle of the city where all these animals have shelter, and there's a another house across this little sort of moat, and they're listening to operas all night and all day, and they're disgusted with the noises of the animals across the way. And at one point, one of them's looking and scolding out the window, and her husband goes, "Hortense, you'll miss the aria." And I'm like, what other kids' movie is going to do that? And I actually compared it also to the best way I could think of was my friend, she'd seen both Bill and Ted movies, and I'm like, now this is going to sound weird, but you know how the first Bill and Ted is them going in time and doing their thing, and the second one has got nothing to do with that. They just go in a completely different direction and do a bunch of imaginative stuff. That's what this is. It goes, well, we already did the farm thing. Let's do something completely different and completely crazy and just see where it goes.
And it really is completely different. I mean, you're right that it's very much not like the first movie, and and it's very much a sort of, yeah, this fantastical, strange, unreal world. I mean, you know, the probably the most sort of blatant and obvious depiction of that being when Babe looks out of the window at the city.
Right, and it's all cities in one.
It's every city in the world. It's got, what has it got? I made notes. Here we are. It's got, okay, skyscrapers from Chicago and Manhattan, the Golden Gate Bridge, the Hollywood sign.
That thing from Shanghai, the big tower with the ball in it.
I thought that was the Berlin Fernsehturm.
Oh, maybe it is. I could be wrong.
But either way, it's one of those, yes. The Eiffel Tower, the Sydney Opera House, Christ the Redeemer is there.
Yeah, it's all there.
Statue of Liberty, Red Square. I mean,
then they own it. They go across the bridge at one point, and there's the city. It's not just this one throwaway shot. It's like, no, they're actually in this.
Yeah.
And plus, in the city, everybody, except for a couple key characters who show kindness, are all wearing black, white, gray, or something in between of that. And there's one shot in the airport where this kind custodian shows up who kind of looks like he's got a very piggish, for lack of a better term, face. And he's all in orange. So you notice him, and he sort of pops out because of that, which I always thought was a really smart, subtle way to do it.
I hadn't noticed that. I can't believe I didn't notice that. Wow. I mean, not that he was in orange, I noticed that, but the everyone else is in black, white, or gray.
Oh, yeah, especially in, there's a whole scene, except for the farmer's wife, obviously, and then once you're in the house, the woman who owns the house is the tall sort of olive oil-looking lady. She's also dressed in different outfits, but generally speaking, everybody else is in black, white, gray, and it's very much a weird 90s fashion-forward area, but then everybody's driving around in 50s cars. Like, they mix and match all the time periods together into this mush, which is actually really interesting.
Yeah, it's very heavily visually stylized. I talked about this actually in a recent episode, talking about Batman Returns and how the Batman cinematic universe did that same thing. You mentioned Tim Burton, and they did that same thing with Anton Furst's city designs, but all the cars are from the 1940s.
That's right, yeah.
And people's suits are from the 1930s, but telephones are from the 1980s, and it's all very much sort of mashed up. And yeah, this is kind of the same, although all of the you know, the riot girls and the leather-clad bikers and the people on Venice Beach and stuff, that's very, very 90s.
quite 90s, and all the fashion billboards are very, very 90s as well, very cold and stylized, and they just look like, oh yeah, I remember that kind of thing being popular at the time.
Yeah, so you mentioned that this is directed by George Miller. It's co-written by George Miller as well. And I think he, didn't he co-wrote the first as well?
I think he did, yeah.
Yeah. And as you say, has also made Happy Feet and, yeah, Witches of Eastwick, which is a wonderful movie. I love Witches of Eastwick. And also, most famously, the Mad Max movies, including the latest one, including Fury Road.
And if you watch the set pieces in here, you're like, oh, I can see, just like in Fury Road, all the stuff where he storyboarded for a year beforehand, you can totally see that hand at work with all the big set pieces. And there are a lot of them in this, all the big set pieces of like disaster and chases and all the rest of it happening.
Yeah, especially the finale, you know, the climax of this, and we're jumping ahead now, but the climax is 15 minutes of just completely choreographed chaos.
And Marx Brothers Mayhem is the way I like to look at it.
Right.
Plus, even down to the woman turning the orangutan going, how appalling, which yes. I just love seeing every time.
But, I mean, George Miller, for heaven's yeah. sake. You know, so many people, I know this just from, you know, my own interactions. So many people have no idea that this is the guy. You know, either people love Mad Max and they know him from there and have no idea that he made these movies, or people know him from stuff like this and Happy Feet and have never seen Mad Max and have no idea that he does this really, you know, crazy, sadistic, post-apocalyptic thing as well. It's, I mean, it's nuts.
Yeah, it is. It really is. It's a lot more complicated to get credit for. Plus the dialogue. I listen to a lot of this dialogue and I'm like, this is not aimed at a 10-year-old. Like, you've got this Doberman saying, yeah, you suffer from a suicidal, or not a Doberman, a pit bull. What the pig says goes. Anybody else, you know, stuff like that. Yeah. It's just, he's throwing a dictionary at you and it's kind of nice.
It is. Well, I mean, I'm a big advocate of not talking down to kids mm-hmm. in, you know, media that's aimed at them. So that was something that immediately struck me in this, was that yes, the language is not that it's overly complex, but yeah, it's not baby talk.
No, not at all. It's got the stuff the kids want to see, but it's all done in a way that an adult can appreciate, or that it's like, as the way to put it, I guess, was when I was a kid, I would listen to a CBC radio, which is our equivalent of the BBC, or I guess NPR. And they've always tried to sort of make it appeal to teens. And I've always said, don't bother. Smart kids will like this for what it is to begin with. And that's kind of what this is. It's like, this is for the smart kids.
Right, yeah.
You will enjoy it.
Yeah, there's an old... I come from, and we just talked about this off air before we started, I come from the world of consumer magazines. And there's an old truism mm-hmm. in British consumer magazines, at least. I'm not sure about, you know, over the pond. But over here, there's an old truism that... people, kids, that is, until they become adults, always read magazines aimed at people 3 or 4 years older than them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have a succession of girls' magazines over here that are literally titled after ages, you know, 13, 17, stuff like that. And it's 9-year-olds are reading 13, 13-year-olds are reading just 17, and the 17-year-olds are already reading Cosmopolitan. Kids do not read things that are aimed at their age group, and I think that's the same with movies. They always
especially
want,
when told to.
Right, exactly. If they know it's aimed at their age group, they'll go, well, that's for kids. I want to watch something, you know, that's aimed at people older than me, because kids always want to feel more mature than they are.
Mm, of course.
Or, you know, mature for their age, I should say. So, yes, I can well imagine that even the young kids that this is truly aimed at probably would have quite liked. I mean, I don't know. I've never sat and watched this with a kid, but I would imagine they'd quite like the fact that it doesn't talk down to them. I still find, you know, the George Miller connection just...
It is a little baffling, isn't it?
It just blows my mind, you know, that this is what he's best known for in sort of mainstream Hollywood. It's crazy. Although, I mean, you could argue there's an old saying that inside every cynic is a frustrated idealist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe that's because I enjoyed this. I'd never seen this before. And I actually did enjoy it for the same reasons as you say, because it's clearly just a well-constructed fantasy. And mm-hmm. I was trying to think, like, why would a guy like George Miller make films like this? But then I was like, well, I've written rom-coms, and, you know, sometimes even though I'm best known for things like, you know, post-apocalypse and spy thrillers and stuff, and very cynical sort of fiction, and I did think, well, you know, sometimes there is a bit of a desire to go, what if everything was actually all right?
You know? Yeah, exactly.
What if things actually were nice? Wouldn't that be a lovely time?
Well, I mean, I'm not a big fan of most rom-coms, but I do like it when they have fantastical stuff thrown in. For example, L.A. Story. It was one of my favorite movies of all time. I don't even like Los Angeles all that much, but it is a fantastic movie that completely lies about Los Angeles. So that's another example. It's like, yeah, sometimes you just like stuff outside your comfort zone for whatever reason.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, Pretty Woman lies about Los Angeles as well, so, you know.
Yeah, true.
I think pretty much every movie does, so let's not get into that.
Yes.
One thing I wanted to mention with this was you were right when you said you sounded like you weren't sure about the year at the start, but it is indeed 1998.
Oh, good.
Which is pre-Matrix.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Yeah. And yet there is clearly a fair amount of CGI in this, You know, lots of special effects work, obviously, because you can't get real talking animals. Hello. And it's pretty good. Like, it's really well done.
It still holds up. Like, you watch it and you're like, wow, that you can tell, you can see where the seams are a little bit, but you forget 5 minutes in. You just kind of ignore it. Like, it's not a big deal. And then there's parts where I would assume some of it's CG. A lot of it's animatronics, I'd assume. And some of it's, you know, actual trained animals, which that's the other thing people forget. There's so many animals in this thing. It must have been an absolute nightmare to make.
Right, the old never work with children or animals thing, yeah.
Yeah, and like...
This set's filled with dogs.
Yeah, and cats. Yeah. Like, how do you get cats to go in a proper formation? I have no idea, but...
I figure the cat choir, some of that has to be... CGI compositing,
or
if not
puppets, yeah right, for sure.
Not necessarily CGI cats, but you know, compositing and stuff to get a bunch of real cats to look as if they're standing together in a choir. I do like the cat choir; it amused me.
The effects company, Rhythm and Hughes, who went bankrupt a few years ago, and they're going bankrupt, kind of point out a lot of deficiencies in the VFX industry in terms of protecting their workers. Anyway, they were known for this. This was their main thing. I think they did the stuff. I might be wrong about this, but I think they were the guys behind Life of Pi as well. And this was kind of their thing, was animals. They were known as the gold standard for it, and that's why they. And this either was proof of that, or what got them in there in the first place, that and Babe.
Right, right. So let's rewind a little, and how did you come to watch this? Because you are an adult. You were,
and was then too.
Right, and you were an adult when this movie came out, exactly. So how did you come to be watching this in the first place?
I think partly because I'll watch anything if it's good, and I like the first one, and I think my girlfriend at the time wanted to see it, so I'm like, yeah, okay, fine. And then she enjoyed it, and I was just like, this is amazing. Seeing this on the big screen is incredible. I think somehow they snuck this by people. Sometimes you watch a movie and you're like, they didn't. It's like Gremlins 2 is a good example of that. Like, they said, go make this movie, and so he just made exactly the movie he wanted, and you're like, I can't believe Warner Brothers gave him money to make this. That's how I kind of felt about this one too. It's just like, I can't believe Universal actually gave him money and then said, oh, okay. But they did.
They did. Gremlins 2, actually, funnily enough, is another film that we've covered on this show in an earlier episode with Rich Dansky. I love Gremlins 2 for exactly that reason, because it is just...
Oh, it's brilliant.
Yeah. And, okay, so that actually gets into something else about George Miller, which is when Fury Road came out, obviously, it was so built up. There was so much anticipation. And then when it came out, and it didn't disappoint. And one of the things that I noticed, and I wrote a blog post about this on my Tumblr or something. One of the things I noticed was that a lot of the praise for that movie came from creators, came from writers and filmmakers and artists and what have you. And the theory that I posited was that, I mean, not that, you know, critics and stuff didn't like it as well. But I theorize that the reason creators loved Fury Road so much is because, I mean, it clearly cost an awful lot of money to make. You know, it was not a cheap film. And yet, you can tell that it is the uncompromising vision of not necessarily Miller alone, you know, but it's a singular vision. Now, a singular vision can belong to a group of people working closely together, but it is a singular vision. And creators, I think, know more than most how difficult it can be to get stuff like that, as you say, past the studio and the money men. It's crazy. And so, you know, Fury Road is really, it's amazing that he somehow succeeded in making this crazy movie that no sane businessman would ever go, yeah, that sounds like it'll make money.
I mean, he had a little bit of edge because Babe was such a big hit at the time. So he kind of got a more or less a blank check, I'm assuming, with this one. And then used it, which they probably didn't see coming, but...
Right, yeah, well, and like I say, and this didn't actually make its budget back, which is probably why there's no Babe 3. But it is, I think it's always fun to see a director doing that, having that license and using it.
I think another part of it, too, is like, you can see this in like, maybe 2000's kind of an arbitrary dividing line, but I'm going to use it anyway. Up to this point, with CG being where it was and all the rest of it, you still had to make movies this way. Everybody had to make movies this way, where you intricately plotted this stuff out. And now, one of the reasons guys like Marvel or whoever else can just hire some guy who's made two indie movies and put him in is because the pipeline has kind of moved in the other direction, where you make Jurassic World and you shoot stuff and then it all gets filled in after the fact on a computer. So you can, it's instantly malleable, which makes most of it kind of unmemorable. You look at Jurassic Park, the original, and you know, okay, it's also Steven Spielberg directing it, but it still holds up. And those are more than 20 year old CG effect, you know? So because they had to plan every single thing just down to the micron. And I don't think you have to, I might be wrong. I don't work in visual effects, but I get the feeling it's like games. You're creating more of an environment that you're filling in nowadays than it was way back when it was a very precise document.
Yeah. I don't know many people who work in visual effects, but the people I do know would probably say, yes, that does happen. And that's why lots of modern movies are bad. You know, I think they would agree with you basically that isn't how you should make a movie. But yes, it is possible these days. And that's the answer as to why a lot of movies these days, well, I won't say a lot, but why some certain movies do feel a bit kind of soulless, because
one of the reasons. Think also the rule by committee is part of it too, which you got less of back then. So
that's true. And I mean, talking about stuff being storyboarded up the wazoo, again, that's something that Miller did with Fury Road. Fury Road, he worked with Brendan McCarthy, famous British comics artist and storyboarder, for years, for, you know, a long, long time, working on sort of concepts and storyboarding out the action part of the story on that movie. And I'm going to guess, as you say, because some of this is so well choreographed and it is from a time when you couldn't just go, oh, it's fine, we'll fix it in CGI.
Yeah, exactly. You just couldn't.
Did the same here.
I mean, Jumanji, when did Jumanji come out? 3 years earlier? 1995, somewhere around there?
Something like
And those are almost unviewable animal effects, although pioneering at the time. This is so far gone from that you know most of it can't be CG. It's got to be animatronics.
Right, right. Well, I think things like the close-up on the duck are... that's definitely, you know, an animatronic.
Oh, yeah.
Because it doesn't move like a real animal. But, you know, but the distant shots clearly are an animal. And things like lots of the shots, body shots of the dogs and of, you know, Babe himself, and that clearly are animals with, yeah, just a bit of tweaking here and there on the mouth and stuff for CGI, which is really impressive.
Mm-hmm. And one thing I love about this is more down to the writing, is that almost every animal has its own unique personality. Like Thelonious, who's this very dignified orangutan.
Yes.
he's just kind of like the moral center of the whole thing in a weird way. Well, I guess Babe is, but he is also one of the moral centers of the movie. It's just interesting to see, like, and just the great lines, like the two other orangutans, Stephen Wright and Lena Headley, Glenn, I can't remember her name. Something Headley, who deliver those crazy lines with it. What a momentum. And it's, you know, that sounds easy to say, but it isn't to do properly. And they managed to pull it off.
Yeah. I mean, Stephen Wright is, when I realized that was Stephen Wright, as I think they're chimps, actually, those. I think Thelonious is the only orangutan.
Right. Yes. You're right.
Yeah. They're chimps. Yeah. But when I realized it was Stephen Wright, I mean, that immediately got a big thumbs up for me, because I am a massive Stephen Wright fan.
And he's great.
He is great as well. Yeah, he also, it's the perfect, I think the great thing about the voices that each of these animals have, and some of the voice actors do more than one animal in this as well. But they're also perfect for the animal they're portraying, for the, you know, the sort of species and breed of animal that they're portraying, without being horrible stereotypes. For the most part,
exactly.
In any case, like the chimps, you'd almost expect the chimps to be kind of hyperactive, and instead you get Stephen Wright.
Yeah, they're very kind of low key and a bit conniving.
You're just kind of down and dirty. Yeah,
but not Thelonious. Thelonious isn't. He's like I say, he's the only part I really have a problem with that 20 years later is Mickey Rooney is a bit. And I feel kind of bad because knowing that he was kind of going through that at the time, I think this is one of his last roles. You're like, this feels a little exploitative, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can't blame him. It's the you know, it's the times and the script he was given. I mean, it's one of those things where it's a good performance. You know, if you're willing to sort of look past the issues that the character has per se, it is a good performance. He does a really good job, even in some of the slapstick parts.
And that's where some of the darkness and whimsy comes together. Like, you're in the hospital, these kids clearly have cancer or something, because they've got, you know, shaved heads or they're bald, But they're sitting there and there's all this happy stuff happening and there's these bubbles, and somehow it isn't cloying, it isn't depressing. It's just this life-affirming thing in a weird way.
Yeah.
And there's numerous instances in the movie where, you know, like where Fleelik is for all intents and purposes dead. And so you see him in like what I guess is the Rainbow Bridge, and he's dead, he's jumping around chasing, and it's really sad and life-affirming at the same time. Like, you're just like, how is he pulling this off? This is like not easy to do, and he's somehow doing it. And also aimed at kids, but still, you know, pretty much looks death square in the face in a couple of different instances.
Yes, you're all like the drowning pit bull.
Yeah, like, which, you're not sure he's going to live.
Yeah, I was quite horrified watching that, actually. I was like, what, are you actually going to let him drown?
Yeah.
And then the Fleelig in Doggy Heaven, I really thought they'd killed him at first. Like, yeah, I thought, oh my God, they have actually killed this character. This is really quite dark. And okay, they didn't. But even so, I would love to get a kid's take on this movie and see how they cope with some of the, I mean, I'm sure they cope probably better than us.
Yeah.
Right. Better than we think as adults. But even so, you're right. There are some moments in this where you think, oh, that's, wow, really?
Plus, I just love the unvarnished cynicism of the duck. He's just, oh, that's it, done, abandon us. Like, let's get the hell out of here. I just like his lack of affinity for anyone. It really appeals to me.
Yeah. Well, apart from the pig, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Convinced that, you know, the pig's the only thing that can bring him good luck. Talking about the age of the audience, the chapters and vignettes structure.
Oh, yes.
That which is quite unusual, you know, for they did that in the first one as well, I think, didn't they?
Yeah, and the only other place I can think of is Quentin Tarantino movies, which are a completely different bag than this.
Good Lord. You're right, though. But I was going to say, I wonder if that was done. I mean, partly it helps in terms of story compression. Mm-hmm. And isn't it nice to get a movie that's only 90 minutes long?
It doesn't feel like it.
No, it doesn't, absolutely. But, you know, you can, if you divide things into chapters, you can generally cut out quite a bit of linkage that you would mm-hmm. otherwise need. So
that's
it
true.
Helps with that. But also I was wondering if it was to do with, you know, if they thought it would be an aid in keeping the attention of small children.
Well, maybe. I thought it worked just as it reinforces the storybook feel of the whole thing, where, you know, we've seen pop-up books like this where you wait for the one page and you open it and it goes out into your face. And that's kind of what this movie is. It's got a series of pop-up scenes, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah, with the singing mice introducing each one. It is the mice, isn't it, that sing?
Yes.
Yeah. Which... That amused me as well. The mice singing in Moray especially. I don't know why, for some reason, that really cracked me up.
It just really works. And man, does this movie look good, besides all the imagination. Like, it's just incredibly well shot.
Yes, yes, it is. Well, beautiful colours, lovely use of colour. And yeah, just really sort of, the cinematography is great, the camera work even is great, and obviously the sets look amazing.
And I've got to say, the gag they used twice with the two pig-looking guys, which might be the same actor or not, I'm not sure. For whatever reason, especially the first one, just chokes me up every time.
I think the first one is the judge.
Oh, no, the first one is the custodian in the airport.
That's right, sorry, yes. Right, and the second one is the judge.
For whatever reason, his kindness just makes me feel good inside. I couldn't tell you why, but it does.
It's kind of a cheap gag. You know, when he turns around and, yeah, you know, he looks like a pig. But yeah, I mean, it works. You can, I'm willing to, again, given that it's a kid's movie, and I'm willing to sort of let mm-hmm. that pass. One thing that I noticed as well, talking about the farmer's wife, because that's the scene at the start where the farmer's wife, she loses the pig and she eventually gets arrested because she's trying to search for him and stuff. I noticed that once she's arrested, we kind of fully enter the animal's world.
That's right, we do, yeah.
And from that point on, until the pest control guys get called in, you hardly see any humans at all, and you don't clearly see any human faces. Even the neighbors, when the neighbor woman across the canal with the opera is looking out and sort of tutting and what have you, you don't clearly mm-hmm. see her face. She's in shadow, she's looking away. You know, there's lots of the shots with humans in them are taken from ground level, looking up at humans. It's the sort of thing that I think, I mean, not that it's not necessarily obvious, but at the same time, it's not played for gags.
No, you know, it isn't.
They don't hang a lantern on it, but it's just kind of there and like, well, yeah, sure. You're in the animal's world now. So now the camera angles are all low and people are just, you know, generic people.
Yeah, yeah. I couldn't put any better than that, frankly.
It's just really kind of struck me as a nice, again, not necessarily subtle, but just a nice, intelligent piece of filmmaking that didn't pander.
One thing I've noticed is with a lot of the humans, it seems like, and I don't know if this is intentional artistically or not, it seems like they're doing a lot of ADR, a lot of overdubbing of them. And sometimes it seems like that's sort of intended to make it this otherworldly voice, if you know what I mean? Like, because you're going to do that, you have to do it with the animals, obviously. So maybe to mesh it together, you also do ADR on the humans, because a few of the pest control guys are just, it seems like their voices are a little removed. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but that just seems like, it feels like it's a little, they're more remote because of that.
That's possible. I mean, it's also possible that that's just a case of they picked people who looked good, but then, replaced their voices.
And I don't know where they shot it. They might have had non-American accents.
Yes, it was all shot in Australia.
Oh, that would make sense then. Yeah, because you don't very much, I don't think you hear any, and I'm not sure what accent she's got. Maybe you'd be, if it's an English accent, maybe you'd be better at picking that out than me.
The farmer's wife, she's got a Scottish accent.
Oh, okay.
Although she's an Australian actress.
Oh, okay.
Well, I think she's a British stroke Australian actress who's basically lived in Australia so long that, you know, she may as well be Australian now.
Right, right. Mel Gibson was Australian, but might as well be American.
Right, yeah. Yeah, a reverse situation, yeah. Miss Flume, I'm not sure. She's an American actress, right. So she was probably using a sort of regular, what's it? James Cromwell, I mean, he's not in it much, but obviously he's American, of course. And there aren't that many human-speaking parts, really, are there?
No. And I guess that all fits because it's this multicultural city anyway. So you can just have these weird generic accents that just kind of fit anywhere.
Yeah, I think the one time that you might hear an actual Australian accent is on the plane.
Right, yes.
I think the announcement is an Australian accent. But as you say, it's clearly not meant to be set anywhere.
Well, and on the plane, I noticed that the stewardess, or sorry, flight attendant, she's talking in, not in English, it might be Swedish or Russian or something. It sounds like it's completely, you know, divorced from reality. And everybody in that plane is also dressed in black and white and gray too, as I recall.
Ah, right. Again, I hadn't noticed that. Yeah. It's clearly not meant to be set anywhere real, you know, more specific than the country and the city.
And it's got that great line at the end where it goes somewhere a little to the left of the 20th century, which I just think is a fantastic way to put it.
Yeah. Yeah, that was very good. The plane scene was where I first noticed all the sort of strange accents and thought, oh, okay, well, this clearly, you know, they're not trying to say, oh, this is America and pretend it's America.
Well, and there's funny social commentary too. Like you've got the pink poodle who says, when I was dizzy with privilege and I nearly fell over backwards, I was laughing so hard. It's because she's this weird Southern belle or whatever she is. it's kind of a standard thing to put, it's a thing you do sneak into kid stuff because you can, you know, it's like.
Right. Well, and she's kind of, I mean, I don't know, maybe this is me reading too much into it, but she kind of came across like a streetwalker to me.
Yeah, well, she does come across as like, we've all probably met somebody, male or female, who is putting on like they're well more wealthy than they are. And that's putting on airs, for lack of a better term. And she's kind of that, is, I think. Like, that's the general sense I got, that she's somebody who keeps trying to be as fancy as she was. Like, for instance, the in Titanic, where you've got the American aristocrats who have no money. That's kind of what she reminds me of. We just got to keep up appearances here, no matter how ridiculous it is.
Right, and she is clearly on the hustle as well. That's the other
thing. Oh, yeah, totally. And then she abandons the poor pit bull at the end.
Yeah.
Which, again, made me feel a little uncomfortable, because I'm like, this is a bit of a stereotype, but it is pretty funny and very well done.
I think that's the thing. They get away with that one because it is funny.
Yeah,
I had the same thing. I was like, really? Really? You know, this is the thing kids are going to take away from that?
Yeah, kids won't care. They'll just say, ooh, she's pink, presumably.
But I guess. talking about the very end, one of the things that blew my mind, Peter Gabriel did the theme song?
Yes, he did. Apparently, he was a huge fan of the original, and that's why he did it. But just like if you've ever seen A Life in Rock with Brian Pern, which is a direct spoof of Peter Gabriel's career, he shows up at the end of every, like there's six shows per episode, three shows per season. And at the end of the third show, he'll show up in a sort of duel with Brian Pern, the character who is meant to be basically him. And they'll sort of square off in different ways. And one, they're looking at each other on segues. And in the third one, they actually reenact the Long Good Friday with Peter Gabriel as the Pierce Brosnan character with the gun. It's absolutely brilliant. What? So he is not above making fun of himself, which has nothing to do with this. He just liked, from what I read, he just liked Babe a lot. And that's why he did the song.
That's nuts. I had no idea about that show. I'm going to have to look for that now because I'm a huge Peter Gabriel fan. So.
Oh, then you definitely check out A Life in Rock with Brian Pern. The first one is a documentary style mockumentary by a bunch of Doctor Who fans because they throw all this Doctor Who stuff in for the devoted that under the radar about this guy who's got a Peter Gabriel-like career and all the ridiculous things he did in the 70s with his band Thotch. And then by the second and third season, it's about them reuniting and Peter Gabriel shows up in last one of each of them. Sorry to give it all away, but it's if you're a Peter Gabriel fan or a progressive rock fan or just a fan of taking the piss out of either of those, you'll enjoy that.
Wow. I wonder, because I know Gabriel has, children, and I wonder if it's a case of, he sat and watched the first one with his kids.
That wouldn't surprise me, especially in 1998 when they would have been a lot younger.
Right. Well, in the first movie was 95, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know, but I speculate. I wonder if that's got, if that
wouldn't
something
surprise
to do
me
with
at
it.
All. Yeah.
But either way, I was, when the credits rolled, it's like, oh, wait a second, I recognize this voice. He has a very unmistakable voice as well.
Especially after Randy Newman, who did the first one.
Oh, really? Was that Randy Newman? Good Lord.
Well, I think he was mandated to any kids movie do the song for it after Toy Story. So.
Probably. That was like, really, Peter Gabriel? But, whatever. It's like the old, so many actors do kids movies in the sort of middle of their careers. And when they're asked why, they inevitably say, because I want to make something that my children can watch.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I wonder if there was something similar going on there with Gabriel.
That wouldn't surprise me, yeah.
And so let's talk about that climactic scene then, because that is, it's probably the most slapstick part of the movie. And there are quite a few slapstick parts in the movie, but that is absolutely slapstick with the giant rubber bands and the balloons.
Oh, yeah.
And
while I was watching, I was like, this doesn't make any sense unless you're a kid. Because if you're a kid, of course they would start bouncing around doing this as opposed, like, they don't have any actual reason to get that pig other than to cook them. Like, and really, just go get some ham. Like, you don't need to do that. But it makes sense if you're a kid. Just like the guy protecting his giant thing of a champagne statue thing. I'm like, why does he do it? Just let him hit it. Like, it's really not that big a deal, buddy. Like, just because you put all that time in it, I guess that's why you're doing it. But again, it all makes sense. In the context of if you're a kid watching it, yes, this is of course what they would do.
Yeah, I must admit there were a couple of moments as an adult watching it and going like, just leave the room. But of course,
yeah, exactly.
You can't do that. That's not an option. But it is so well choreographed. And
oh yeah, like it's so complicated.
Yeah, and you've got like what, three people bouncing around at one time?
Yeah,
I think towards the end and.
Including a late middle-aged woman.
Right, and the farmer's wife is in that enormous clown suit as well.
Yeah. It's pretty crazy, actually.
It is, yeah. I mean, you're right, that must have taken so much storyboarding and choreographing and what have you. But
imagine making it. Like, you've got all those extras, you've got all these people flying around. Like, it must have been a nightmare. You do that all on green screen now. There'd be no way you wouldn't. Actually, now that I think of it, this is not that I wish this, because I'm not a huge fan of 3D, but I think this is a movie that probably would have benefited from 3D, to be honest.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I'm not a fan of 3D either, but this is one of the few movies where you think, actually, this would probably be quite fun in 3D, because things move so much throughout the whole movie, but especially in that final scene, again, with the balloons and people sort of doing that weird elastic band wall of death and stuff.
But even in the contours of the sort of main set, that whole sort of moat and series of buildings, like, there's a lot of stuff you could do. It reminds me of Hugo in that, Martin Scorsese did stuff with 3D that normally people don't do. Like, he did really smart stuff. Like, he really understood volume and sort of building an atmosphere around the kid and his adventures. And then he would do stuff like, he had a shot when the train comes in the station in a silent movie. That's all in 2D, but the audience is in 3D and they react to it in such a way that it really brings you in. Or they have Ben Kingsley at the end, and he slowly and subtly becomes more and more 3D and more in the audience. And it's just him. I could see George Miller doing that kind of stuff, doing really experimental stuff with it, as opposed to just, here it is in 3D, big deal.
Right, yeah. I wonder, Fury Road wasn't in 3D, was it?
They were planning originally to do it in 3D, but it was such a nightmare to do because they wanted to have all these cameras they did have all these little cameras in the vehicles to record everything. But they just found it to do it in 3D would be so unwieldy at the time. I think maybe by the time they finally got around to doing it, it might not have been, but at the time when they were planning, it was just like, there's no way we could do this. They did it 2D and I think they extracted 3D. I've never seen it in 3D. I have 2D glasses to keep me from that abomination. but having said that, I have been told the 3D is pretty good. So.
Right. I think it depends very much on the movie. Like I say, I'm not a huge fan, but yeah, this is a movie that I could see, you know, maybe would benefit from, and who knows, you know, if it had been more successful, if it hadn't lost money, maybe they would, you know, it's the sort of movie where they'd go back and remake a 3D version, as it were. But
wasn't Miller up to originally, like, I think it might have started around here that they're going to do a Batman v Superman movie, and he was the guy for a while.
Really?
That was going to be the world's finest movie. I could be mixing this up, but I think, and it's even referenced in I Am Legend when he drives by a Batman and Superman world's finest or a similar marquee. And I don't know if they say George Miller, but I'm sure that he was, for a few years, he was the guy. And then it just kind of, he said to hell with it, which, you know, and now upon reflection, it's probably the sensible move.
I think that was probably a good career move.
I could be misplacing my directors here. I could be wrong about this, but I think he was the guy that they were talking to about making a Superman, Batman type thing. And this would be around this time or a little bit. It was before the DC Cinematic Universe was a thing.
Right. Well, presumably then also pre-Marvel.
Yes, it was pre-Marvel.
Yeah. Or pre-the Marvel, you know, pre-Iron Man, which is what kicked off the modern Marvel universe.
Which is what, 2002, I think?
No, 2008.
Oh, really?
Yeah, well, Iron Man was 2008.
Oh, you're right, because Spider-Man was 2001. So yeah, it wouldn't have been 2002.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, and that wasn't a Marvel movie, then, remember? Those are Sony movies.
True, yes. Yeah, you're right. I totally forgot about that. I thought Iron Man was a lot earlier than that.
No. No, the Marvel Cinematic Universe isn't even 10 years old, and it's already taken over the world. So the score was composed by Nigel Westlake, who also did the music for the first movie.
Has he done it for anything else? Because it just seemed really to fit perfectly well, and it just didn't, and it crossed various moods too, but I've never seen anything else he's done. Not that he hasn't.
He is an Australian musician, composer, and conductor. Wow, I'm just looking at his CV here on Wikipedia, and it's lots and lots of things like winning gold medals and first, you know, winning orchestral awards and things like that. But yes, Babe 2, A Little Bit of Soul, never heard of it. The Nugget.
Never heard of that either.
He hasn't done a lot.
Well, he's probably done a lot we haven't heard in Australia, maybe.
Yeah, no, it doesn't look, even in Australia, it doesn't look like he's done a lot of movie stuff since. I think it seems like he went back mainly to doing concert and symphony work.
Yeah, if that's where the money is, and that's what he likes doing, then more power to him.
I can't imagine there's more money in that than in doing film
scores. Probably
schools,
not, but no. But
I don't know. Who knows?
Could be like Alan Dean Foster, who used to write novelizations, or still writes novelizations. He worked in Hollywood for a couple of years and said, and then I moved to Arizona, and I've never been happier.
Yeah. Oh, not to New Mexico. That makes a change.
Oh, sorry. Was it New Mexico? It might have been.
If it was, he would be following in the footsteps of many, many other people who have basically quit show business and gone to live as a cheap life as an artist in New Mexico.
Yeah, George R. R. Martin did that for exactly the same reasons. He was just done with all the nonsense of Hollywood. And you can see why, given, look at this movie, like they made it in Australia. He somehow swung it under the radar.
Yeah. Well, and you know, now, I mean, again, The Matrix was filmed in Australia.
Oh, that's right. Yes, it was.
And that was made, that would have been sort of being made, well, that would have been in pre-production while this was being filmed, I imagine.
Yeah, that's actually true.
So, I mean, I don't know if there's any crossover in sort of the crew or anything between the two movies, but I know that that time period was a period of great growth for the Australian film industry in terms of Hollywood productions.
That's right. And then after that, the two prequel Star Wars movies got made in Australia.
Right, yes.
But not before. Like, it was in 2000, whatever they were making, Attack of the Clones. The first one was in London, I think.
Well, and then, of course, just across the water in New Zealand, the Lord of the Rings
movies were gearing
up as well at the same time. So, yeah, the whole, you know, down under film industry really got a boost around that sort of late 90s, early 2000s time.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it is a good score. You're right that, sorry, we were talking about the score. Kind of got off topic of it there. But it is a good score. And like you say, it's very much of the movie. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it turns out that's because these are the only two sort of major movies that the guy's done by the looks of it.
Yeah. For some reason, I don't know why, in my head was a Michael Nyman score, which of course it wasn't. It doesn't sound anything like a Michael Nyman score, but that was just the name that stuck in my head. It's not The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and His Lover. Great score, by the way. Completely different movie.
Yeah. Don't take your kids to watch that.
No, really, you probably shouldn't.
Oh, man. All right. Okay. I think we've talked around this enough. So, Warren, thank you very much for coming on the show. Where can people find you if they like what you have to say about talking pigs?
If you like what I'd say about Doctor Who, go to Radio Free Scarrow. You can find that on iTunes or just go to radiofreescarrow.com. My Twitter, if you like seeing mostly stuff slagging off Donald Trump, is at Freiburg, at F-R-E-Y-B-U-R-G. And that's probably the best place to look for me. And then you can go to freiburg.com for occasional blogging.
And who doesn't love blogs slagging off Donald Trump these days?
It's kind of unavoidable.
Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned. You can check out my other work, including comics, books, music, and more at anthonyjohnston.com, where you'll find more information about all of my work. You can support Unjustly Maligned by becoming a member of the Incomparable Network. Go to theincomparable.com/members to sign up and check the box for Unjustly Maligned when you choose which shows to support. You can also help by reviewing Unjustly Maligned on iTunes and following us on Twitter at UMPFM. And the show notes for this episode are at UMP.FM. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
You said, when we first talked about this, you proposed that this is an art movie disguised as a kids movie.
Yeah, it really is kind of an art movie disguised as a kids movie. It's like, it's just, maybe it's not quite that. But it just seems like there's a lot more art going on here than in, say, I don't know, your generic kids movie that they spit out, like Agent Cody Banks or something. Like, there's just a lot more craft going into this and a lot more thought and love for it than. And then it's his own unique voice, which any good art movie is, right? So as opposed to, here's more Hollywood generic stuff at a 9 to 13-year-old bracket or whatever. That's kind of what I mean by it.
Yeah, it's not Ice Age.
No, exactly. It's not Ice Age. But then there's nothing wrong with those kind of movies. Or, you know, or let's say Wreck-It Ralph, which is a really fun movie, but it's definitely that kind of a generic quote-unquote movie, whereas this is definitely its own thing, would like it or lump it. Which is not something you normally see in a kids' movie.
Well, I think the thing that comes across, and you do get this actually in the Toy Story movies. The Toy Story movies don't feel, much as Pixar have tried to make every movie they make feel like Toy Story, the Toy Story movies don't feel like every other Pixar
movie. That's true.
And I think that's because of John Lasseter's, you know, firm hand on those three movies, you know, mm-hmm. firm hand on the tiller. And I think you could say the same about this. You're right. This doesn't feel like a generic kids movie. And part of the reason for that is George Miller. It is clearly, there is an authorial intent. And mm-hmm. I hesitate to use the word auteur because, you know, it's so overused and
yeah, obviously and misused.
Right. And on this movie and the previous movie, he co-did lots of things. So, mm-hmm. you know, I'm sure Miller himself will be the first to acknowledge all his collaborators. Nevertheless, they feel like the product of, again, like Mad Max Fury Road, of a vision. And mm-hmm. yeah, you know, they feel like there is an author here with opinions, an opinionated author, rather than somebody just sort of sanding the edges off.
And this is something where I take a lot of flack from people. And I'm not saying the prequels are better than Force Awakens, but the prequels are certainly an authorial vision as opposed to the Force Awakens. Like it or lump it, and for a lot of it, lump it, like the stuff that's coming out of there is right out of George Lucas's head, as opposed to the Force Awakens, which is kind of not. but it's much more generic in that way.
I would agree with that, actually. I mean, I love The Force Awakens. I really did, you know.
And I like Rogue One even more, but... But having said all that, these are definitely, and I think Rogue One runs with it a little more because they say they're times 10, all the stuff of the original of New Hope, sort of weirdly enough, makes it its own animal, which does make a hell of a lot of sense, but that's how it feels. But Force Awakens seems like kind of a nostalgic retread, whereas the prequels, a lot of it is, there's a lot that's wrong with them. Like, I'm not going to sugarcoat it, but who boy, is there a lot of imagination going on in them? Like, you know, whether it's good or not is up for grabs, but there's a lot of imagination there. It is definitely somebody's vision.
Yeah. Well, and not just imagination, but, you know, they don't look like any other movies. I mean, we've covered the prequels actually on this show. Mm-hmm. The first year of the show, we did one episode per prequel movie leading up to The Force Awakens, mm-hmm. Over the course of the year. And I despise the prequels. I mean, I absolutely, if they did not exist, I would be no worse off whatsoever.
And I probably would be either, except for maybe 20 minutes of Sith. But
but I agree with you that they do clearly have an authorial vision behind them. They don't mm-hmm. look like any other movie. They are unmistakable. You only need to see a couple of frames from any of those movies and go, oh yeah, that's one of the Star Wars prequels.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, for good or ill, that is at least something distinctive about them.
And you could say that probably about the first three Star Wars movies as well, even though two of them are directed by somebody like George Lucas, they do have that unique feel to them. Like, it's almost, I know this is going to get a little ridiculous, but when you see a Kubrick movie and you instantly know it's a Kubrick movie, you know, it's got that weird clinical distance to it. That Spielberg almost but not quite got in AI, you know, so it's fun to watch because of that, just to see him fail.
Try.
Interestingly. Yeah.
Yeah. And more one-point perspective. That's what you need. Oh, Hugo Weaving.
That's right, yes.
It says, like, what, three lines?
Yes, but they're great lines. And that's before he was kind of a big deal, too. Well, I mean, he'd probably done Priscilla, Queen of the Desert at that point, and not a much else.
And not a lot else. I think that's the thing, exactly.
Like, at least that we would have known about. I'm sure he was probably a fairly big deal in Australia to begin with. But
Right. But in terms of sort of Hollywood movies, yeah, you know, it was, in fact, Matrix and Lord of the Rings that we mentioned, which made his name. Mm-hmm. So yes, when he did this, he would have been a fairly jobbing actor, I imagine, which is, I'm sure, why they could hire him to just say three lines.
Yeah, exactly. Or maybe he owed a favor, who knows?
But it delivers them very well. And Miriam Margolis as the other collie.
Well, that's right, yes.
I don't know whether that will mean, well, it might mean something to you, because I know you're a fan of British TV. But to most, certainly Americans, that name probably means absolutely nothing.
Well, actually, it doesn't mean anything to me either.
Oh, she's kind of a national institution over here. She's not sort of, I mean, she's not famous in the sense of, like, you know, she's had a big defining role mm-hmm. that's beloved and what have you. But she's been in lots of things. And
she'd be like Christine Baranski over in the States, who's been in tons of stuff. You go, oh, her, but she's not famous.
Right. But the thing that Miriam Margolis is most famous for is another thing that was voice work. She did a series of adverts for Cadbury's Caramel Chocolate Bar, playing a sexy bunny. and that's probably what she's best known for. Like, when she dies, I guarantee that will be one of the first things in her obituary on the news. I think the ad industry in general in Europe is a bit more sort of, you know, arty and up itself.
I think you're right. I think you're right, definitely right about that. You don't see that many anymore here. I remember the first time I understood what cinematography was the two Chanel No. 5 ads, for which were just weird, which were actually, now that I think of it, kind of similar to Babe Pig in the City. There were these weird melanges of all these different periods of time shot in this very weird arty style, which I think, I could be wrong about this, but Ridley Scott might have had something to do with them. Like, but now that I think of it, that approach that they took in those commercials is a lot like what they do in Babe Pig in the City. Maybe that's why I like it.
Maybe. And it wouldn't surprise me in the slightest, actually, if Ridley Scott has something to do with them, because obviously, you know, he's sort of kept his hand in on commercials throughout the years.
And these ads had to be good for some 9-year-old straight kid to care.
So, right. Well, and I was going to say, the one that always, that people over here always remember is, I think it was Calvin Klein Obsession.
Yeah. It's kind of in the same vein, yeah.
Yeah, with the crazy sort of surreal black and white adverts and stuff. And I'm pretty sure those were made here in Europe first.
No, that wouldn't surprise me, yeah.
And they kind of set the template for, you know, perfume commercials are still riffing on that
That's
idea.
True, yeah. That's like 30 years later.
So whoever did come up with that campaign, you know, that's literally changed the world. That's kind of
amazing.
I hope
they're very rich. They probably aren't, because that's usually how it works.